From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with our pre-Independence Day special. First up, meet Philadelphia native singer and actor Leslie Odom Jr. He's best known for portraying Aaron Burr in the hit Broadway musical Hamilton. We spoke a while back about how he got the role and what it taught him about the realities of American history. Then we'll hear about the song Lift Every Voice and Sing, which has been called the Black National Anthem. Our guest, Princeton University professor Imani Perry, wrote a book about the history of the song and its importance to the Black community. Lastly, we'll hear from history humorist Sarah Vowell about her obsession with the Marquis de Lafayette, the French aristocrat who fought in the American Revolutionary War. That's all coming up when Radio Times continues after the news.
One thing in life I can control.
Wait for it, wait for it, wait for it, wait for it.
I am inimitable, I am an original.
Wait for it, wait for it, wait for it, wait for it.
I'm not falling behind or running late.
Wait for it, wait for it, wait for it, wait for it.
This is Radio Times pre-Independence Day special. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're going to begin our show on American identity by listening back to my conversation with Philadelphia-raised actor and singer Leslie Odom Jr., best known for his role as Aaron Burr in the Broadway hit Hamilton. The movie version of the musical airs on Disney Plus tonight. We spoke back in 2018 about what the role taught him about America's past and present, his life prior to his award-winning performance, and his thoughts about the American dream. Odom had just published his memoir, Failing Up. Let's take a listen. I want to play some music from Hamilton. This is Aaron Burr, sir.
Okay.
Where Lin-Manuel, who of course plays Hamilton, meets Aaron Burr, and you play Aaron Burr. And this is from the original Broadway cast recording of Hamilton. You want to say something?
Yeah, I want to say something. This is the song that's most sung to me by little kids. I expected, I think because of how Rent found me, I thought that the show would appeal to teenagers. But the 3- and 4-year-olds, this is the song. They sing to me.
Because it's Aaron Burr, sir?
I think it's the rhyming. I do. I think it's the sweet little rhyming, yeah.
Let's give it a listen.
New York City.
Pardon me, are you Aaron Burr, sir?
That depends. Who's asking?
Oh, well, sure. Sir, I'm Alexander Hamilton. I'm at your service, sir. I have been looking for you.
I'm getting nervous.
Sir, I heard your name at Princeton. I was seeking an accelerated course of study. When I got sort of out of sorts with a buddy of yours, I may have punched him. It's a blur, sir. He handles the financials.
You punched the bursar.
Yes, I wanted to do what you did, graduate in 2 and join the revolution. He looked at me like I was stupid. I'm not stupid. So how'd you do it? How'd you graduate so fast?
It was my parents' dying wish before they passed.
You're an orphan. Of course, I'm an orphan. God, I wish there was a war. Then we could prove that we're worth more than anyone bargained for.
Can I buy you a drink?
That would be nice.
While we're talking, let me offer you some free advice. Talk less.
What?
Smile more.
Huh.
Don't let them know what you're against or what you're for.
You can't be serious.
You wanna get ahead.
Yes.
Fools who run their mouths off wind up dead.
Yo, what time is it? Showtime!
Like I said.
Showtime, yo! I'm John Lawrence in the place to be.
And that's our guest, Leslie Odom Jr., singing with Lin-Manuel Miranda from Hamilton. I love all the puns and the burr, sir.
Yeah.
And burr, sir.
Yeah.
And yeah. It's fun. And you also write in this book that it really was the language in Hamilton that just grabbed you.
I mean, that's the second song in the show. You know, what you're bowled over by on a first listen of this show is how he sustains that level of excellence. You keep the third song in the show. The next song is My Shot, which again, it just every song is better than the last. And he's managed to do a really difficult thing. It's really hard. Everybody wants to do this formula, figure out how to make popular music work in the theater. The music in the theater, the emphasis has to be on the storytelling. It has to be new information that's revealed. That is the nature of the theater. We need new information, you know, coming at us all the time. And so in the theater, if you repeat a chorus, you know, if it's not new information, there's something in an audience that dies. And so Lynn, Jonathan Larson did it, you know, in Rent so beautifully too, you know, which also was in the same way it affected me. It affected Lynn. Rent was the show that brought Lynn to the theater as a writer anyway. Yeah. And Lynn has made popular music work on stage. It's a really hard thing to do.
What was it like to be part of a black cast playing white founders of this country? Did it make you think differently about history to be able to be Aaron Burr?
It did. It did because the exercise really, you know, I was a theater major in college. I went to Carnegie Mellon University, the conservatory program there. And, you know, theater was, you know, drama is what's listed on my diploma. But really, I majored in empathy. You know, I majored in...
Is there a difference?
No. That's what I'm saying there. You know, they're synonymous that, you know, that's what theater is about for the performers anyway. It's about sitting in somebody else's shoes, you know, sitting, putting yourself in somebody else's shoes and trying to make a case for them, you know, building a case for the way somebody else lived. And so it was, I had never done that with the founding fathers before, even growing up in Philadelphia.
Imagine them as another color besides white, you mean?
No, meaning I had never thought of what it was like to have been them, is what I'm saying. You know, I never tried to sit stand in the shoes of a founding father or imagine what it was like to be George Washington or Aaron Burr or Alexander Hamilton for that matter. I just had never done that as an exercise. Even growing up in Philadelphia in this historic city, I just, you know, I go, I look at the sites and, you know, they feel separate from you. Mm-hmm. They feel different. And this show was really about all the connective tissue. It was about exploring all the ways that we are alike. There are still many ways that we're different. You know, some of these men were slave owners. You know, some of these guys were not. There are many ways that we're not like each other at all. But this show in particular, Hamilton, was about exploring all the ways that we are the same.
You grew up in Philadelphia.
I did.
You sang in the church choir. Did you have this voice that we heard? How much did you have to work to develop the voice that you have?
Oh, a lot. I remember asking, there was this singer that used to work with my mom. My mom's always worked with the aged community in Philadelphia, in nursing homes and rehabilitation centers. And there was just this woman, Paula, that she worked with who happened to be a singer as well. And Paula was a fantastic singer. And she used to be able to do all the runs and the trills and, like, you know, just her tone was so beautiful. And Paula was probably in her 20s, and I asked her, like, you know, what do you do, like, when you're not that good? I'm not as good as you are. Like, what do you do? And she said, you will be. Just practice. Give yourself time. You know, just
really?
Yeah.
She must have heard something in there.
She must have. Yeah, I remember. It was such a small thing, but she told me that stuff came with time, and I never forgot it. You know, I kind of held out hope maybe one day I'll be as good as Paula.
With Hamilton, as you said, 8 performances a week, how much did you have to just stay in shape physically, vocally, and all psychologically?
Yeah, you're kind of like a pro athlete when you're doing the Broadway thing. I had a nutritionist, and I got great training at Carnegie. So I really am prepared for that kind of schedule. You know, doesn't mean you can be lax when the time comes, but I really am prepared to sustain. It's part of, you know, yeah, being a professional. You know, I remember when I went to do Rent, I went to do Rent on Broadway at 17, and I was losing my voice, and I was, you know, I was young, and so a lot of what I was putting my body through, my body, you know, was resilient. These days I wouldn't be able to.
Yeah, you can do that.
but yeah, since training and since college and some experience, I enjoy that. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you this, Rent, I've never to this day, I've never had a job for a year in my entire life. Rent is the, Hamilton is the only time I've had a job for that amount of time. So there is a part of that that I enjoy, you know, having this freelance lifestyle that I have, where it's, you know, I shoot a great movie and then I don't work for 2 or 3 months. If I'm not proactive and make things happen. I enjoy that. I enjoy the punching in and punching out of it, because so much of my life I don't have that.
You were 17. You saw Rent in Philadelphia, and there were things that happened on the stage. There was a wink, and it just kind of, as you write about it in your book, it just blew you away.
It did.
And you said, I want this. You got the part. You were 17. And that was really your first time on Broadway.
Well, for sure. I stopped by Masterman. I went to Masterman when I was a kid here. I went there for middle school and a little bit of high school. And the kids did a performance for me. They performed a number from Oliver. And they sang a Beatles song for me. They were lovely. They did a beautiful job. I forgot to mention this to them, but I remember being struck by, when I got to Broadway, I had my first show. There was somewhere in my first show that I was like, oh, wow, this is not different at all.
Oh, interesting.
What I mean is, you know, like there's no pixie dust that gets sprinkled on you at the stage door of a Broadway theater. You don't suddenly become a different performer. There is nothing different about the way that I performed on stage at Masterman, the way I performed on stage at Freedom Theater, the way I performed in the sanctuary at my church. There's nothing different than that and the way I performed on Broadway. It was the same performance, you know? And so, you know, now I travel the stages of the world, big and small, you know, after Hamilton, and I don't bring anything different than I did 8 shows a week at that theater. There's something really beautiful about that, about the sort of that, the way you can start practicing your art and the discipline with which you practice your art wherever you are, right in your hometown. It's the same thing. It's the same discipline that you'll bring. It's the same smile.
Just one more quote from your book. For me, Hamilton was my first real brush with the American dream.
Yeah. There's something about stability and white picket fences and sort of idealism that that I had not found for myself. I felt like I could see it very clearly on my TV screen, see it very clearly at the movie theater. So I knew that it existed for someone somewhere, and you know, for me, Hamilton was sort of that experience. It was idyllic. It was like my perfect little paradise. You know, I was so grateful for it.
I wanna be in the room where it happens, the room where it happens. I wanna be in the room where it happens, the room where it happens.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
That was my 2018 conversation with actor and singer Leslie Odom Jr. about his role in the musical Hamilton, which you can see tonight on Disney+. Up next, we'll hear from Princeton University professor Imani Perry about the song that is known as the Black National Anthem and its importance to the American Civil Rights Movement. Stay with us.
We dream of a brand new star.
What we dream in the dark for the most part.
Dark as a tomb where it happens.
Welcome back to the Radio Times pre-4th of July special. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Up next on our show about America and its many identities is Princeton University professor Imani Perry. We spoke recently about Lift Every Voice and Sing, a song from 1900 commemorating the 91st birthday of Abraham Lincoln, a song that eventually became known as the Black National Anthem. Perry discussed how the song became so important to the civil rights struggle and its relationship to the Star Spangled Banner. Perry's book on the subject is called May We Forever Stand. Let's take a listen. We asked you, who's your favorite singer of Lift Every Voice and Sing? And you chose Esther Satterfield from a 1974 album, Once I Love. Tell us why you love this version, and we'll play a portion of it.
I love it because it's jubilant. And it's optimistic. It has the energy of the 1970s in it, right? The kind of sense of possibility of that period. And it's also the version I played on the record player all the time when I was a little girl. You know, usually I sang it with community groups, but this was a song that I listened to frequently in this version.
Well, let's give it a listen.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring. Ring with the harmony of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise high as the listening skies. Let it resound loud as the rolling sea. Sing a song full of the faith that the dark has taught us.
Esther Satterfield, Lift Every Voice and Sing from the 1974 album Once I Loved. And our guest, Imani Perry, says her favorite version of this song, and that's what her book is about. You begin this book with your little son humming this tune. And you ask him, where did you learn that?
Right, yes.
You were surprised to hear him?
I was. He had learned it at a private Quaker school. School that was predominantly white. I was surprised that he learned it in that context because, of course, my experience of the song is overwhelmingly in Black community contexts. And I asked him, you know, where did you learn it? He said, at school. I said, do you know what it is? He said, yes, the Black National Anthem. And then we went home to my home in Alabama for the holidays, for Thanksgiving. And I asked him to stand up and sing the song, which is sort of a commonplace Black Southern practice to have children perform.
Oh, is that? I did not know that. Okay.
So I asked him to stand up and sing. And the entirety of my family stood up with him and sang with him and raised their fists. And his eyes were like saucers in response. And it was really powerful for him to actually have a moment where he understood through this performance together the meaning of the song. It's very different than simply explaining to someone, you know, this is an important song, but the action of what it meant, to understand what it meant to sing together, was really powerful.
Did you do that as a little girl with your family? Was it a song that was sung together?
No, I can't think of any specific instances. It was usually in my experience, it was usually sort of celebratory occasions, like, you know, the annual Martin Luther King Jr. breakfast or Black History Month programs, or, you know, Kwanzaa or those type of events. But I didn't tend to sing it at home, although I played that version. We just listened to it at home all the time. But that sense of community was always central to my experience of the song.
Why did these brothers write the song? What was the inspiration for them? And I should add that James was the lyricist,
yes,
and John was the composer.
Yes. So these, you know, so the Johnson brothers were what were called race men of the period, right, as well as Renaissance men. So they saw they were highly accomplished, but they had been socialized to think everything that they did that was of importance was for the race, right, and for uplift, so collective uplift. And we have to understand that this is a period in which that the historian Rayford Logan referred to as the nadir of American race relations, right? So the possibilities of Reconstruction were destroyed. Lynching comes. Segregation is legalized, right? So it's in some ways the lowest point. You know, the promise of the Civil War has been denied. But you have also in this period this remarkable development of organizations, of organizing, of pursuing education, of pursuing political goals, all these things that are happening in Black communities. So the song really captures the energy of that turn of the century moment. And that's really why I think it grows almost immediately, right? The sense of striving that is so intensive in Black Southern communities.
And the first segment of it is optimistic and celebratory.
Yes.
The second is more about the past. It's about suffering.
Yes.
And the third is a much more sort of reverent, religious part of the song. There isn't any mention there of race per se.
Right.
Or the United States
that's
per
right.
se.
That's right. Yes. And I think that's important. Part of what it does is it tells the story of Black life in epic terms. It makes it it talks about Black people in sort of grand terms, universal terms. And this is important because this is a people that are deemed as not having any history, right, of any significance, right? And it's also important to not name a specific nation, because you have to think about in the context of empire, really, kind of all these European empires, there are actually very few, you know, there's Haiti and Liberia, there are very few Black nations. And so it really is a way of expressing a kind of patriotism that isn't bound to any of these places that actually deny the citizenship of Black people all over the world, but that really fashions a patriotism from values and from the story, like a story of struggle that isn't about the nation state itself.
Well, yeah. It's interesting how this becomes appropriated, I guess, as the black national
yes.
anthem. And the NAACP does in a sense pronounce it. But you also say it was promoted by the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs even
yes.
before that.
Which included a lot of Black women teachers, organizers. I mean, it was really important that the proliferation of the song happened almost immediately. I mean, in the 1910s, through the labor of Black women organizers. And the Johnson brothers really didn't envision the song as a Black anthem. I mean, it sort of happened. I mean, what's incredible is it happened organically. It's just sort of spread. And Victoria Earle Matthews, who was a Black woman public intellectual in the 1910s, really almost immediately started referring to it as an anthem.
Oh, interesting. Not a song, but an anthem.
An anthem. So it's interesting. So it was referred to first as kind of collectively as the National Negro Hymn, and then the National Negro Anthem, and then sort of it progresses. And actually, the NAACP has always rejected the idea of calling it the Black National Anthem officially, because the organization saw itself as, look, we're trying to be fully included in the United States. We don't want to call this, there's only one national anthem. And yet when they adopt it as their official song, there is a way that they're reaching out to a Black public that has said, this is our anthem, and saying, yes, we're connected with that vision.
Well, you include something that James Johnson said. He said, there's nothing in Lift Every Voice and Sing to conflict in the slightest degree with the use of the Star Spangled Banner or American. He says it's as patriotic as those songs. But then he goes on to say, and I think people would agree with him, it, certainly in terms of singing this song, the music of the Star Spangled Banner is derived from old foreign drinking songs, difficult to sing. In addition, the sentiments are boastful and bloodthirsty. Words of Lift Every Voice are more elevated in spirit. I do not hesitate to say my brother's music is better than either of these imported songs.
Yes. Yeah.
He was a proud composer.
Yes, he was a proud composer. And there's debates. I mean, that's part of a debate over the song and whether, you know, that happened amongst black intellectuals. Should there be an anthem or not? But like one of the things I think is interesting, though, is before the Star Spangled Banner is adopted as the national anthem of the United States, Lift Every Voice and Sing has been adopted by black Americans, which I think is fascinating. You know, we don't even have as a nation an official anthem until the mid-30s.
And by adopted, it sounds like what you're saying is that it was sung.
It was referred to as thing, pasted in the back of church programs, circulated, you know. One of the things that I loved in terms of the research is going through graduation programs of all these different types of schools. And so it's written as the National Negro Hymn or the National Negro Anthem in high school and college graduation programs, elementary school programs all throughout the South, beginning in the 19-teens.
More in the South than the North?
Much more in the South. I mean, you know, this is also sort of before you have the Great Migration really shifting the demographics of black America, but also part of the story is that segregation actually facilitated the creation of these black institutions, both schools, but also all kinds of civic organizations. So there was a sort of, you know, world within a world. So it is more in the South because of that.
You mentioned that within the black community at this time in the early 20th century, there was, I guess, a debate, an argument about this song, but also what this song represented. And you do include a parody, and I guess it was parodied.
Yeah.
The communists, or certain people who were communists at the time, did not care for this song, which they saw as the official song of the NAACP.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Here's a version, George B. Murphy. Lift every voice and sing till communism rings, rights with the true Soviet liberty. Let our revolting rise high as the listening skies. Let it resound loud as the rolling sea.
Yeah.
So does this represent some kind of a argument within
leadership
at the time?
Sure. And George B. Murphy was a communist and a member of the Murphy family. He's actually my children's great-great-uncle.
Is he really? Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
On the other side of his
family. All in the family,
yes,
right?
Yeah. In some ways he was critiquing the mainstream, in that moment critiquing the NAACP for not taking the stronger stands on social issues that the Communist Party would touch. For example, the Scottsboro Boys case. You know, there were cases that the NAACP shied away from in terms of defending black people because they thought it sort of would tarnish the image of black America. So the parody is actually a way of kind of commenting that the limitations of some of the civil rights organizations on pushing for justice.
It's so interesting whether these institutions were built in response to, as you say, the segregation, the rise of the KKK, Jim Crow. So you've got these forces, in a sense, working against each other.
Right. And the thing that I think there's the part of how they're working against each other is right. So that the society's doors are closed. But there's also something that's really profound about emancipation, which is it's a moment when people who were enslaved get to imagine how they want to structure their society. Right. That most people don't go through that kind of transition, right, to be wholly excluded from a kind of formal social political world to how are we going to fashion this, right? And so that even though the country sort of abandons and fails black Americans after Reconstruction, there's still that sense of vision, right, that people are pushing forward and really sort of in some ways take advantage of the exclusion to sort of do their own thing in many ways. It's just really profound.
Well, it's here we are in a time and place where we're arguing about the national anthem.
Oh, all over again. Yes.
Does that surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me because as part of, you know, doing the research on the history of this song, you know, I encountered earlier moments in which the Star Spangled Banner, in moments of protest, the Star Spangled Banner became this a representation of protest of racial injustice. All right. So if we think of Colin Kaepernick's kneeling for the Star Spangled Banner, you know that there were other events in the 1970s, for example, that are very similar to that. And the way in all of these occasions, right, Lift Every Voice and Sing has sort of emerged as an alternative or as a kind of critique of the Star Spangled Banner and its failure. The failure of the country to live up to its promises of equality.
And it has some problem words.
Oh, absolutely.
And
yes.
In the Star-Spangled Banner.
Right, yeah. I mean, like a constitution. I mean, we can't run away from our history.
I wonder, and this is a song written in 1900, so yes. It's more than 100 years old, whether mm-hmm. during the civil rights movement of the 50s, 60s, even into the 70s and beyond, whether we shall overcome... sort of overcame
yes.
Lift Every Voice.
Yes, it did. In the 60s, We Shall Overcome and to a lesser extent other freedom songs like We Shall Not Be Moved in some ways displaced Lift Every Voice and Sing, which was often the song that people sang at protests before. The freedom songs made sense in the context of that movement. One, because lots of people were coming, lots of students were coming from the North, black and white students who didn't necessarily know Lift Every Voice and Sing. But also the freedom songs were easy to learn, easy to improvise on. You didn't need instrumental music to go along with them at all, you know. And so they displaced Lift Every Voice and Sing for a while. But then Lift Every Voice and Sing really comes back with the turn to the Black Power movement, which is fascinating. And in some sense, that's, you know, again, a moment of turning inward, building institutions, much like the turn of the century.
But you don't, I mean, this is probably a gross generalization here, but
yeah.
It doesn't feel like a Black Power song, if you know what I mean. I mean, in many ways it is embedded
yeah. mm-hmm.
in this, is about Black Power, but it's not.
Well,
overt.
Yes. Well, I think for me, you know, and I have all these sort of various intentions with the book is actually to give a more robust picture of the period of the late 60s and 70s, because I think, you know, we talk about Black Power, but we tend not to talk about Black consciousness. And so much of that period was about sort of consciousness and community building and like sort of learn. And a lot of it was about learning history. Right, recuperate.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
In the past. And so the song becomes part of that, right? So it's not, the Panthers have their own anthem. It's not a Black Panther anthem.
Right, no.
But for lots of the, you know, lots of other sort of Black organizations that are thinking about both returning to an African past, but they talk a lot about the past in the Deep South in that period, too, and sort of blend those things. And the song becomes part of that fabric.
That was my 2018 interview with Princeton University Professor of African American Studies Imani Perry about her book, May We Forever Stand, The History of the Black National Anthem. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from history humorist Sarah Vowell about the Marquis de Lafayette, the French aristocrat who fought in the American Revolutionary War. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Radio Times Pre-Independence Day Special. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're going to close out today's show about American identity with my conversation with humorist and amateur historian Sarah Vowell. In her book, Lafayette in the Somewhat United States, Vowell explores the American Revolutionary War as seen by and fought by the French aristocrat, the Marquis de Lafayette. Her book examines his life and the political divisions then and now. Let's take a listen.
What's interesting is that it seems, I mean, clearly you love the Marquis de Lafayette, but it seems that America largely loves Lafayette.
They certainly used to. I don't know, like, nowadays he's more of a place instead of a person, you know? I mean, after he came back in the 1820s, and it was this 13-month-long love fest, partly because he was the last living general from the Continental Army. All the old founders were dead or dying, and that trip inspired everyone everywhere because he visited all the states at the time, the naming craze that we're left with.
Because he went to all these various places. At least in New York City, what, half of the city came out to see Lafayette?
Yeah, more than half. I mean, Philadelphia was a really big deal, too. I think they had, in Philadelphia, they had hired this French chef to make this meal, this multi-course meal that was so elaborate, and it was so hot out that the chef actually died from the effort. But his visit to Philadelphia on that trip was very sweet and sentimental, and he goes to Independence Hall, or he calls it the Hall of Independence, and, you know, talks about the importance of what happened in that building.
I do want to have you read from the beginning of your book, but I have to say your book reminded me that Lafayette was a teenager. What, he was 18, 19 years old when,
19,
he, came, when
yeah.
he came to the colonies to fight against the British. I mean, you think of, I realize people didn't live as long back then, but nonetheless, really a teenager who came to find, I think, himself here in this country.
Yeah, I mean, he came for a few reasons. One of them was that the British had killed his father in the previous war, so he had a bit of a grudge. Another reason was he actually believed in the Enlightenment ideals about liberty and equality. But, I mean, he was only 19, but he came from a military family and grew up in that French military tradition and culture and had been to writing school with future kings of France and was part of the King of France's household troops. So he actually had way more military experience than most of the grunts on the ground around here.
In fact, you also remind us that the colonists who fought against the British, I mean, the soldiers were hungry. Many of them sort of fought almost near naked. I mean, it's really kind of a I realize the book is full of humor, but it's really pretty shocking to be reminded how truly desperately needy these soldiers were.
I know. I mean, it's very meaningful around here because of Valley Forge and that, you know, classic visual of Valley Forge of the bloody footprints in the snow because the soldiers were marching there in the winter and many don't have shoes. And, you know, I mean, Lafayette talks about that and how, you know, they had to amputate the limbs and then they set up their Camp Crummy, I call it, and you know, 2,000 of them die of malnutrition and disease and exposure, and it's kind of an embarrassment. Partly, I mean, it's because the Continental Congress couldn't get it together to supply them with food and supplies and shoes and other luxuries like water, you know. So it's kind of a humanitarian fiasco. And then, you know, spring comes,
right,
as it does, and
yes,
the ones who lived are retrained, and then it becomes the Valley Forge story of them becoming a professional army and trotting off to victory.
I feel like I've seen that movie, perhaps as a child. Well, you visited a number of historic sites, Williamsburg.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly were just outside of Philadelphia, Brandywine Battlefield as well. I mean, that is certainly part of your research.
Oh, yeah. I mean, actually, Pennsylvania figures in a lot to the Lafayette story because, I mean, he was wounded here. It's here he comes when he first, you know, arrives in America trying to get a job. Valley Forge, he was there for part of that winter. So, yeah, Pennsylvania is kind of central to his time in the war.
You quote Jefferson about Lafayette's, quote, foible as a canine appetite for popularity. It also seemed like he had daddy issues. The way you write about it, he saw George Washington as a kind of surrogate father.
Yeah, I mean, canine. He does have a puppy dog quality. It's part of his charm, but it probably does get on the nerves a bit, too. I mean, he was an orphan. He was an orphan by the time he was 11, so he did kind of have that orphan's. And he was also an only child, you know, which adds to the petulance, I think. No, I don't know if you're an only child, but
no, I have one, but that's okay. No,
yeah.
I know what you're talking about.
Well, you know what they're like. So, yeah, he did have this kind of yearning to be well-liked, but it had practical effects. Like, you know, he wanted Washington to like him, so he worked really hard, and he always pitched in. He was very gung-ho. Meanwhile, a lot of the Americans were just deserting in droves because they were, like, I need food and money and shoes, and I'm not getting them here. But here was this kid who just wanted everyone to love him.
And apparently George Washington did,
among others. Yeah. I mean, Lafayette.
He seemed kind of lovable.
He was. I mean, he has a certain, I guess he always used French words. He had a joie de vivre and a je ne sais quoi.
Oh, altogether.
Yeah. But, I mean, I wouldn't have been interested in him if he was just a flirty swashbuckler. I mean, he really did work hard. And even after the war, you know, a lot of the ways he helped the new American nation were really boring grown-up things like helping Nantucket whalers get the contract to light the street lamps of Paris. You know, he wasn't just this kid wanting a bunch of attention. I mean, he, like, that's love, you know.
That's love and a lot of hard work. He did, though, leave behind a wife. He left behind a child, a pregnant wife.
Yeah, they already had a child. I mean, they were so young when they got married, and she was a teenager, too, and he left her behind. She was pregnant, and yeah, I don't let him off the hook for that.
No. Do we know how she felt about that? We know what he said to her.
Could have been happier, you know. She was really sad. I mean, she loved him, but she was kind of the perfect wife for him because she believed in him and was, you know, constantly taking care of him and being on his side.
We were talking about some of the women folk that the men left behind, I guess.
I mean, the war, you know, the first shots of the war fired in 1775, but the rebellion goes back 10 years before that when to the Stamp Act. And there were, you know, 10 years of resistance. And the women were really at the forefront of resisting Parliament's taxes upon them, and especially through boycotts and boycotting luxury goods from Britain, especially fabrics. It's sort of the advent of the homespun movement. I was always also thinking about, like, you know, the Boston Tea Party and how, you know, that's still inspirational to civic-minded hotheads today. But really, you know, the way a lot of colonial women in hordes dealt with that was they just swore off tea. And then they would do things like, let's boil basil in water to make us feel better. But really, I was thinking about that. And, like, what is more valiant, like throwing crates off a dock or years and years of taking care of children from dawn until dark without caffeine, you know?
Television.
Oh, God.
Well, let me quote you to you and to our listeners. This is about visiting Brandywine Valley to trace a soldier's steps. I don't think I see American history as war. I see it as a history of argument, a daily docket of estrangement and tiffs, big and grand like the Lincoln-Douglas debates, big and stupid like the impeachment of President Clinton, or small and civil like what's happening at this moment with these strangers in these pews. This is you talking about being some Quakers.
These strangers were Quakers. Yeah, I'm sure around here you've had...
We know about Quakers around here. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But the idea that this is that we're one big long-standing argument. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that's what's happening today.
Oh, completely. I mean, when Lafayette gets here, he's kind of surprised by how much discord there is amongst the American side. And, you know, there's a whole conspiracy to fire George Washington. And Lafayette writes Washington from across the camp at Valley Forge, basically saying, this is only after he'd been here for 5 months, I feel like the Americans can defend themselves. Like, they can successfully fight the British if they would just stop fighting with each other. You know, and Washington replies about the fatal tendency of disunion. And... I mean, that certainly comes from the beginning, down the road at Independence Hall. I talk about, like, the first thing that happened in the Continental Congress. One guy said, let's start with a prayer. The second thing that happened is two Episcopalians stand up and say, no way, we have too many religions, we can't pray together. And maybe they should have just called it quits right then and saved us all a lot of heartache, you know. But I ultimately came... to believe that that is not our failing. I mean, this argumentative strain of our culture, which is so part of our DNA and comes from this town and the people who gathered here and established a government based on the separation of powers. I mean, that inspires
That's
a lot
failing,
of separation. No, it's not a failing. I think it's our strength. I mean, sure, it makes things inefficient and constantly annoying. And especially for me working on this project, because I was trying to research during the government shutdown of 2013 and Independence Hall was closed. But the book ends talking about places named after Lafayette. And I'm making the claim that to me, the most meaningful one is Lafayette Square across from the White House, where people protest.
Absolutely.
And the disagreeability of preserving independence that goes on there, and how not only do we get to protest there, you know, if some foreign dignitary is in town from some less than democratic place, his citizens will come to Lafayette Park and protest him in America, because if they did that back home, they would be thrown in jail. And I see that as like something we can all be really proud of, and this constant, like, you know, yelling and argument and debate, while it does have its disadvantages, it is the privilege and the right of a free people. Wow, I'm getting all pontificating. I think this town brings it out in me.
Well, and even a reminder of what happened in Yorktown, as you say, without the punctuation of French gunpowder, it could have been a different result in that battle.
For sure. I mean, there was the French were helping the Americans secretly for a couple of years, but then in, I think, 1778, they signed the official, thanks to your boy Ben Franklin, they signed the official Treaty of Alliance, and that's when France sends over gunpowder and guns and cannons and the Navy and the Army and Rochambeau, and you know, they... at Yorktown, which is basically the conclusive battle of the Revolution, there are more French sailors and soldiers at Yorktown than Americans, and it's the French Navy blockading the British General Cornwallis, who's, like, hemming him in at Yorktown. That's why he surrenders, and that's basically the end of things.
Well, I love the way you describe the French soldiers. You say, as if stepping out of a Tchaikovsky ballet directed by Wes Anderson, the French soldiers wore plumed black hats and white on white, brightening their snowy leggings and jackets with pops of color on the lapels. They're sometimes pink lapels. Obviously, in contrast
to the...
They're
still French, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
In contrast to the nearly naked American soldiers.
I know.
Were...
It was a kind of, I mean, one of the, you know, one of the French soldiers or one of the French officers in his journal, he writes about George Washington hosting them in his tent for dinner. And the French officer is appalled because Washington serves them the dinner all on one plate. And there's kind of this vibe like, are these people animals? You know, one plate, no courses. But then, you know, once these French soldiers who are so well-fed and well-trained, they see what these, you know, ragtag bumpkins can do on the battlefield, they do win their grudging respect.
And were the French supporting the Americans as a proxy war against the British?
Oh, for sure. I mean, especially in the beginning when it was all just secret, because for one thing, the French were still broke from being beaten by the British in the Seven Years' War, or what we call the French and Indian War. So they're secretly sending some gunpowder and supplies and stuff through the playwright Beaumarchais to... I can't remember how the French foreign minister puts it, you know, basically to... like, keep up their morale to keep the Americans harassing Great Britain. But it takes them a while to decide, like, do we want to enter this war officially? Because when they do sign the Treaty of Alliance, Britain declares war on France. And France spends so much money on our war. They were already pretty well bankrupt. And this pretty much, you know, destroys them and leads to the financial crisis that sparks the revolution and gets our ally, His Most Christian Majesty, King Louis the 16th, he loses his head over it, you know.
Hey,
That was my 2015 interview with history humorist Sarah Vowell about her book, Lafayette and the Somewhat United States. And that wraps up our Radio Times pre-4th of July special. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Kelsey Hansen, and John Ahrens, who edited this show. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thanks for listening, and have a safe holiday weekend.